there's the fear that comes up of our fellow brothers, sisters, citizens, of if you speak doubts about what you're hearing, the message from our political economy and mainstream society and the media is a fear of not fitting in. And a fear of not fitting in if you don't have that boundless optimism, as I was mentioning, which we use that smiley face and comp to sell politicians and toothpaste and deodorants. And fear of feeling guilty is another one. Fear. And then, of course, there is the huge distractions around us that hardly leave us time to look at the, or to hear from within ourselves, cries of distress from our world. And quoting a teacher friend of mine, Judy Leaf, who says, "Our hope is that if we keep all the distractedness going, we will not have to look at who we are. We will not have to feel what we feel. We will not have to see what we see." Keep distracted, and oh boy, is the fabrication of distractedness a major success of our culture and our economy. And being as old as I am, it still jolts me to move into a public space or into a cafe or onto the street or into a beautiful park and see people bent over looking at their smartphone. A technology that keeps us from being present to our world, present to the people around us, present to what we're seeing on the street, present to our own selves. Fear of knowing and speaking what has not been allowed by the authorities of the moment. And that, for example, is an example of that which haunts me, is that the mountains of evidence on the causes of feeding into the events of 9/11 that were excluded from the commission and not allowed in, and how obedient we've been, like a child of alcoholic parents, well, obedient we are, not to mention, don't mention. And that keeps us very easily manipulable, doesn't it? And that reminds me, the message comes through, which I saw, and it's on my memory bank of images, an activist in Australia, Benny Sable, and when there was a demonstration or a rally in to stop the uranium mining, to stop the coal mining, to admit the refugees and so forth. But he would show, and he wouldn't say a word. And because he didn't speak, you really paid attention to him. He was in a black wetsuit, standing on a kind of pyramid of barrels marked radioactive, and on his, and a death's head painted, a skeleton painted on the black suit, but signs on him saying, and it read, "Consume, obey, be silent, die." That's his version of the messages, the key message we get. Consume, obey, be silent, die. And the costs of this, of course, are great. We're silenced in our thinking ability. Our intelligence is impeded. We're silenced in the heart chakra. Close. We're silenced even in the muladhara, that survival chakra, where we don't dare or are reluctant. So many are reluctant to question the political authorities in their preparations for and defense of our values through blowing up the world. There's so much silencing that happens, and that silencing is an internal silencing. So I did that little piece of homework that I promised myself to do about what obsessed me and trying to find out. But now I want to talk about what we do to come alive again, to come back to life, and to this challenge to become more than our culture or that we had dared to dream. And this doesn't depend on whether we think that how dire our situation is, because even if you think that there's very little hope, what an incredible time to be alive. You are happening to be alive at a time when this glorious chapter on planet Earth is facing some really bad situation. You can be there for your brothers and sisters. Would you seriously think that once you knew it was going to happen, would you want to have checked out? You want to be there. So it's an incredible, because that is, of course, you know this. I hope I'm not talking down to you. But you know that it's through a challenge, it's through terrific pressures of survival that each step of evolution arises. At each point, it feels like a kind of dying. What a systems theorist who's also a psychiatrist, Kazimierz Dąbrowski, calls positive disintegration. The old codes of how to get ahead and be effective have to give way to a new kind of heart and mind. More evolved, where you take the challenge itself into you so that you can extend your capacity, the what can come through you, what you can see. So now, in this chapter of my talk, I want to share with you some things that have really been of service to me in measuring up and exploring with other people how we can measure up and how we can allow ourselves to make the grow into the role we can play and the beings we can play at this remarkable point in our journey. And I think I'll begin with a prophecy. It was just a few years after I was this scene I was describing. It was in 1980. That time with the Friends Conference, that I found myself back with my friends, very close friends that I had made while we were in the Peace Corps in India, and that is a community of Tibetan refugees. These were lamas and Rinpoches and scholars and artists and lay people, and it was a whole community who has been rare to find. And so I worked very hard when I was over there to help get them the means for staying together and not being scattered into road gangs and residential schools and camps. And they did. And they have a community that you can go and visit next week. And it's called Tashi Jong. And it's in the northwest of India. And I went back there, as I frequently did since we left India in the 60s. And it was at that point that my best friend in the community, who was a Rinpoche or Tulku, a reincarnated Lama, said that he, I heard from, first from lay people, they said, there's this prophecy that seems to be, it's 12 centuries old, but it seems to be coming true in our time. And so I thought I would ask my friend, Dugu Chögyal Rinpoche, what are they talking about? He said, oh, that's from the Kala Chakra Tantra of the 8th century. And I'll tell you a part that, and so he gave me this, and I has been so important to me and my colleagues that, and I put it in my books. At first I thought it was too sacred to write in a book. But then 15 years later, I saw that other people were putting it in their books after hearing it from me. So I thought, oh, I better write it down to get it correct. Any rate, I'm going to tell it to you. And I want you to hear it, knowing that it's about you. There comes a time when the earth faces, all the beings of earth face great danger. Now I want you to listen with your stomach, so don't write it down. It's written already down, and it's in my books or on my email, on my website. I want you to take it in, all right? So there comes a time when all beings of earth are in unprecedented, greatest danger than ever. At this time, great powers have arisen, barbarian powers. And although they waste their wealth in preparations to annihilate each other, they have much in common. And among the things they have in common are weapons of unfathomable death and devastation, and technologies that lay waste to the world. And it is at this time when the future of all life on earth hangs by the frailest of threads that the kingdom of Shambhala emerges. Now you can't go there because it's not a place. It exists in the hearts and minds of the Shambhala warriors. And actually, you cannot recognize a Shambhala warrior by looking at her or him, because they're no insignia, no uniforms, no banners to show what side they're on, no barricades on which to climb to threaten the enemy or behind which to rest and regroup. Actually, they don't even have any home turf, because always and ever they have to negotiate their way across the terrain of the barbarian powers. And when he said this, I knew that this was a metaphor for the bodhisattva. And he said, now the time is coming where great courage is required of the Shambhala warriors. That's because they're going to have to go into the heart of the barbarian powers and dismantle the weapons. Weapons in every sense of the word. They're going to go where the armaments are manufactured and deployed, and they're going to go into the corridors of power where the decisions are made and dismantle the weapons. And he said, Joanna, mark this. The Shambhala warriors know these weapons can be dismantled. Why? Because they are mano maya. That means mind made. They are made by the human mind. They can be unmade by the human mind. Because the dangers that face us are not brought by some satanic deity or some evil extraterrestrial force or even by some unalterable predestined fate. They arise out of our relationships, our choices, our values. They are made by the human mind. They can be unmade by the human mind. And so, he said, now is the time when the Shambhala warriors go into training. How do they train? I asked. And he held up his hands the way the Rinpoches hold the sacred objects in the great Lama dances of his people. And he said, one is compassion and the other is insight into the radical interdependence of all phenomena. And he said, you need both. You need the compassion because that provides the fuel to move you out where you need to go to do what you need to do. That boils down to not being afraid of the suffering of your world. Because if you're not afraid of the suffering of your world, then nothing can stop you. But by itself, that's hot. That can burn you out if it's all you have. You need the other weapon or tool. And that is this insight, this wisdom into the interwovenness of all things, the radical interexistence, interbeing. And with that, you know that we are so interwoven that this is not a battle between the good guys and the bad guys, but that the line between good and evil runs through the landscape of every human heart. And that we are so interlinked in the web of life that even the smallest act with clear intention has repercussions and ripples throughout the web beyond our capacity to see, discern, or judge them. But that's a little cool, he said. That can be a little abstract. So you need the heat of the compassion. And I remembered then, as he said that, watching the monks in the puja hall, how they move their hands in dancing mudras, and they're moving, often as not, the dance between karuna and prajna, compassion and wisdom. I felt as if that was it. That was prophecy. But I was so excited. I ran down. My family was with me on that visit, and I ran down the hill to where they were staying, and I burst in. And I said, oh, you won't believe what I just heard from Chuja Rinpoche. And I proceeded to tell them this prophecy. And my son, Jack, the one who my occupied Seabrook with, was there. And he listened and he said, but Mom, didn't he tell you how it's going to turn out? Oh, I'm glad you laughed. I'm so glad you laughed, because I laughed too. And I said, honey, if he had tried to tell me how this is going to turn out, I wouldn't have believed any of it. And don't you believe anyone who tells you how this is going to turn out, because it's the not knowing that calls forth our creativity and our courage. That's the price we pay for our creativity and courage, is not knowing. Praise be. Now, I'm noticing that it's really hot in here now. Not blowing the way it did last night. Are you, and I'm sort of worried about you. Shall I wrap up? We could go to a church and get some fans that you can bring tomorrow. Okay. Yes, fan yourselves. That's good. Okay.